Whether you call it football or soccer in your part of the world, Match of the Day Africa Top 10 is the podcast from the BBC World Service ranking the best African players.
This guy is recognised as the best in the world.
Teams.
Ball coming, turn, boom.
And the biggest moments in African football.
The whole world remembers that.
Remember that, yeah.
It's not just African fans.
Match of the Day Africa Top 10. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hi, this is On the Podium on the BBC World Service, with me, Eliza Skinner, where Olympians and Paralympians tell their tales of daring do, and my do is daring to ask the questions no one's ever asked them before, and probably for a good reason. With me always is the BBC's athletics commentator Ed Harry and Paralympian Scout Bassett. Okay, I have a question. You guys like sports, I like movies, and some sports. What is your favorite film performance by an athlete?
There's a lot that aren't good.
Shazam.
at the end of the 90s, a footballer, so a soccer player, transitioned from playing soccer to films. And this is a guy called Vinnie Jones. And Vinnie Jones was a Premier League standard footballer. He played internationally for Wales. To be fair to him, he wrung the most from his footballing talent. And he was best known for fouling players. He, you know, kicking people up in the air.
Like punching people?
Well, I'm not saying that punches weren't thrown during that career.
Okay.
One of the most celebrated images of him is him reaching down behind him to grab a part of an opponent which you simply shouldn't grab.
Oh, no.
And that's a very famous photo of him and a player called Paul Gascoigne. So that's Vinnie Jones, the footballer. And then Guy Ritchie.
I was going to guess it was Guy Ritchie because Vinnie Jones sounds like such a Guy Ritchie thug name to begin with.
Yeah. And that's exactly what he cast him as. In Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, he cast him as, I think it's called Bullet Tooth Tony. And he's got a young son with him. And he's just like a duck to water. He's brilliant. It doesn't come across as stunt casting. The US audience wouldn't have known this was a professional sports person. He's really good. And I watched it again a few years ago, probably about 20 years on. It's still really good. So yeah, Vinnie Jones, a footballer of, and I guess he'd say this too, I hope so, because he was a big, scary guy, but he got the most out of his talent as a footballer. And then when he started acting, wow, just wow.
Nice. Scout?
Can we include wrestlers?
I don't know, because once you start including wrestlers, you got The Rock, you got John Cena. They're almost more movie stars than athletes at this point.
Well, at this point, but they weren't at one point.
Yeah.
But I suppose that's sport entertainment, isn't it? So there's an element of acting and performance.
Yeah.
In
yes.
Hitting people with ladders and jumping off wallpapering tables and all that kind of craziness.
Yeah. It's all choreographed, right? So I think if they were like Olympic wrestlers, if we knew them for their wearing singlets, maybe. But I say no, we're not including them.
Okay. Although The Rock did play football. But I don't think he ever made it to the NFL. He played a little CFL, I think.
All right. Sorry. I didn't realize I was talking to the leader of the Rock fan club. I would have been more careful about how I phrased things.
I do love him so very much. I mean, I remember in the 90s watching Space Jam, loving that and seeing, obviously, Michael Jordan in that. I have not seen the LeBron James remake or version of that. So in all fairness, I haven't seen that one.
My choice would of course be Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in Airplane, which you could make a case for him playing himself, although most of his role is him claiming that he's not him.
Isn't there a bit in that where the little boy kind of wants to talk to him as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar? No, you're whatever he is, Overunger or Dunner, whoever he is in that cockpit. Like, no, it's not Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Yeah, and then he grabs him and he's like, well, listen, kid. Shut up. Right, let's get on the podium. Who's with us this week, Ed?
Our guest today is a gold medal winning rower. After multiple world titles, she won gold for Norway at the Tokyo Paralympic Games, having just missed a podium in Rio 5 years earlier, where she finished fourth. Our guest is also a winter Paralympian, competing at two editions of the Games in cross-country skiing. Away from sport, she was the first wheelchair user to take part in Norway's Dancing with the Stars. And she's appeared on her country's version of The Masked Singer as well. Birgit Skarstin, Welcome to On the Podium.
Thank you.
We're so excited to have you. To guide our conversation, we're going to look at some photos from your life. So why don't we take a look at one of those photos now?
Birgit, this is your podium moment. It's all three medalists from your event at the Tokyo Paralympic Games. And the first thing that strikes us is we can see the water of the lake behind you. You've got your bouquets of flowers on your laps, but you're all wearing face masks.
Yeah.
So I guess before we talk about winning gold and everything else like that, what was it like for you as an athlete competing at the Paralympic Games with a lot of COVID-19 restrictions?
I think we were all just really grateful and happy that we could even be there. Everyone kind of saw the big goal that we've been working on for, you know, 10 years kind of disappear in the distance. And COVID was just such a big thing. The pandemic was just so serious. I think everyone respected and understood, you know, if they had to cancel the games. So just being there was such a bonus. And of course, it was really strange because the games is all about people. It's all about crowds. It's about sharing the moment, cheering together, you know, celebrate with your friends and family and crew. And Tokyo was very different from that. And usually there's just such a big crowd and so much family and noise, but it was so quiet. And this podium moment and almost no sound was just so different from anything else.
Birgit, you're in pretty elite, rare company, being that you are one of just very few Paralympic champions to come from Norway. So I'm curious what the reaction was when you got back home after you'd won your medal.
17 hours after I crossed the finish line, I was on the plane on my way home. It was kind of like I was sitting in the plane and I opened my bag and I was like, yeah, there's a medal there. It happened, you know. It did actually happen. It was really surrealistic when I landed in Oslo. It's a long trip, you know, from Tokyo to Oslo. I was still a little bit like, oh, what's going on? And then I see these fire trucks coming out on the runway, and they started spraying the plane. I was like, what's going on? Are we that dirty, you know?
So that's not a traditional Norwegian thing.
Okay. And the captain, you know, he went on the radio and he's like, we just want to make sure everyone knows he has a Paralympic champion on the plane and this is a shower for you. And that, I think that is at the moment I kind of realized, oh, this is big. You know, and when I got back, you know, also because we've been isolated for such a long time, I thought I was just going to go back to my apartment and go to sleep, you know, and my roomie, she picked me up at the airport. There was lots of media there. It was lots of fuzz, you know, and then it got quite quiet. We were sitting in the car on the way home. I was like, well, yeah, well, let's go to bed. And I came into the apartment. And it was like 1:30 a.m. And someone yelled, surprise! And the whole kitchen was full of people, my whole Olympic team, you know, that I wasn't able to be with in Tokyo, my friends that I hadn't seen in forever, family. They had someone who were playing music. I was sprayed down with champagne.
Did you get a glass also, or it just all went all over you?
Oh, I got so many glasses.
Okay, good. It was a long night.
It was a long night. You know, I was actually doing the morning show the day after on television, and I didn't go to bed.
Excellent.
Oh, that must have been a great interview.
So I just made sure I didn't drink too much in the morning.
Your disability and why you use a wheelchair, it's not something from birth. It was a chain of events set off by having a swimming accident, wasn't it, when you were traveling? So where were you and what happened to you?
I was in Malaysia and I decided to go swimming. You know, I met some Swedes there and I jumped into the water and I hit something and I looked down and just saw that my left leg was gone. So my, you know, the big bone in the left leg was just sticking into the water and the foot was gone. So I tore it off I did have luck, though, because it was a part of it that was still stuck. It was still attached in the front. So I was able to get enough blood all the way into my toes. But right above the ankle, it was pretty torn off. And then they were able to put the foot back on again. It turned out that I had a tropical bacteria that had settled in my leg. And this bacteria started eating the leg from the inside. So I had to go through a lot of surgery. I was sent back to Norway. I had to go through a lot of different surgeries to fix the leg again. And in the end, they were able to fix it. You know, it was quite amazing, actually, what the doctors were able to do. So, however, you know, when I was done with everything and I was pretty much all rehabilitated and back into business, I was back in school, you know, I was living by myself in Norway. They were just going to have a last surgery to move some bone from my hip and down in my leg because it was a hole there. Because the bacteria had eaten some of the bone. And I got an epidural, you know, like anesthesia. And they hit the spinal cord and I got the wrong dose. So I got 10 times the amount of epidural I was supposed to get straight into the spinal cord. And it burned out a level in my spine. And when I woke up again from that surgery, you know, I couldn't feel my legs anymore. And then I was paraplegic from pretty much belly button down. Yeah, I was 19 when I tore off my leg and then 20 when I was paralyzed. So I was quite young. You know, this stage is a stage where you feel really adult.
But you're still not really the best at adult things.
Exactly.
Yes, that's most of my life, I feel like.
And then when you actually grow up, you look back at it and you're like, oh my God, I was such a baby.
Obviously, I've lived with my disability for most of my life, but I know in talking with so many athletes that and people that have acquired their disability later on in life, you know, you lived almost 20 years before you had your disability. I know that there can be this massive identity transition that happens, right? You see photos and videos and you know a life before the disability, and then to sort of reinvent yourself and live a new way. And was that difficult for you, or was it an easy acceptance, or maybe not so much?
I think I was pretty quick in understanding that I was injured. I understood really fast, actually, that I had an injury which was serious and was probably going to be there for the rest of my life. And I think that helped me through the transition in a practical manner. But looking back at it, you know, I'd say that it took me a couple of years to kind of understand and accept the consequences of it. You know, the first couple of years I used a lot of energy trying to do things the way I've done them before and kind of refusing the disability or the injury to affect my life in any way. like one thing, I kept studying. I was studying political science at the University of Oslo. And one of the things that was really important for me was to live by myself. And the student village was almost up in the forest, where it's definitely the most snow in the whole Oslo. And I insisted on living there by myself. And to get to the university every day, you know, I had to kind of get up a hill. It was actually so much snow and ice that it wasn't possible for me to get up there in the chair. So first, you know, I had this bag of sand and I would put sand on the snow and ice. And to let you know, like you do on sidewalks when it's really wintry. When that didn't work, you know, I got myself a big suit, you know, like one of these we use in the farms in Norway. It's like a one-piece, really big, furry, warm suit. And I crawled and I dragged the chair after me. And I had this backpack where I put my books and my computer and everything I needed for studies. And I did this every day. And, you know, it took me almost half an hour to just climb, I don't know, 100 meters. It wasn't very far, but, you know, crawling on the ground, dragging the chair after and lifting a bag with books, it was quite, you know, time consuming. And people, you know, would walk by and they were like, do you need any help? And I'd be like, does it look like I need any help? You know? And I'll be like, you know, actually, I'm listening to a podcast. It is really nice. I'm learning a lot. And this is my workup, by the way. And then, you know, after a while, I kind of realized I was so stuck into the vision of doing it, you know, living my life like everyone else was. That was just kind of missing the point that no one else was living their life like that. It wasn't in my head. It was a physical injury and it was actually difficult. If I wanted to be as independent, if I wanted to be as productive, you know, I couldn't spend all my energy crawling on the ground, carrying my books. You know, I needed to spend it actually studying. So that's what I mean with saying that I understood I was injured, but I didn't understand the consequences of it. And I didn't understand how to live my life with it until I actually had tried to kind of understand where my borders were, you know, and one thing is what can I do, but what is it smart that I'm doing? How can I rationalize my energy? How can I work with my body and not against it, you know?
It makes me think like the difference between wanting to go to your classes the same way everybody else does in the same exact manner versus using up the same percentage of energy you have for the day to go to your classes. Like rather than I'm going to get there the same way, like I'm going to use 10% of what I've got, just like they're using 10% of what they've got. And that's a different type of equitable.
Yeah. And also that you just, I looked at myself like I did before. It took a little while before I kind of realized, oh, you can't walk. Yeah. Oh, I can't walk. Maybe I should actually respect that fact.
You're listening to On the Podium with me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. Our guest is winter and summer Paralympian, Norway's Birgit Skarstein. Ed, I think we have another picture.
So this is you in your chair, and behind you, is that your mother?
Oh!
And whereabouts was this picture taken? What's happening?
Yeah, that's my mother. It's my apartment, actually. It's outside of my apartment. Actually, this picture is taken by a photographer that I wanted to make a piece about, you know, the mother-daughter relationship, you know, and how it was for my mother to experience something as traumatic as having a child getting such an injury. And also me thanking my mother for always being there because I haven't been too easy to be with, you know. And this picture, actually, it's my mother walking behind my chair. And she's holding my chair. And that's because the photographer asked, can you show us what your mother does to help you? And I was kind of like, oh, she doesn't help me. But we can fake it. It's okay. So I'm just jumping down one step and my mother is touching the chair. And you know, talking about that, you know, I have so many times that my mother has tried to help me and really wanted to help me, especially the first couple of years. I would, you know, I would just like back at her being like, get away from me. Don't help me. Don't do it. You know, she got yelled at so much. I feel bad for her today. But I think I just had a really strong sense of needing to be independent. And she had a really strong sense of wanting to help me. And, you know, she used to sit down beside me and she'd cry and she'd be like, oh, I wish I would be the one that were paralyzed. You know, I wish I could switch with you. I'm so sad. You know, she was so sorry. She so much wanted to take the fate herself. And I just so much wanted her not to feel sad for me and to show her that, you know, it's going to be fine. When I was in hospital, she used to say, you know, when you're well again, we're going to go to Spain. When you're well again, you know, we're going to go vacationing. And when you're well again, we're going to go to the movies. You know, and I'd be like, oh, so we're never going to go to Spain, huh? You know, I'm actually paraplegic forever.
We've laughed a lot already chatting to you. We can see you face to face and we can see your smile. And I know people listening will can hear the smile in your voice as well. But you mentioned it was a traumatic event. Did you have a time when you were you let yourself be angry? Or were you also aware that, like, maybe others in your family, like your mother, they were angry on your behalf because this is an accident or a mistake caused this, and it happened to you, and the chances of what happened to you happening, that's pretty high odds for something like this to happen. So did you ever just think this is unfair? This isn't right?
No, I think I thought it's life. You know, some people they win the lottery, some people they get in a car crash. You know, it's not, you can't control life, and it happens. You know, that's just how it is. And I think I thought all the time that, you know, I have this life. That's a good start, you know, and I got 20 years walking, which is nice, and I'm still alive, you know, I can breathe, I can use my hands, I can talk, you know, if I try to not compare to what was before, and I try to not compare to what could have been, and I try not to compare for what should have been. No one gives you a book, you know, when you're born, no one gives you this contract saying this is how your life's going to be. That doesn't happen, you know. It's sometimes things turn out a different way than you thought they would, but then again you base your thoughts on statistics and what you see around you, and it's unpredictable. And I drew a really hard line in the sand saying, like, from this day on, what was before is not any more relevant in many ways, like comparable. I can't say, oh, it was so much easier before, because that doesn't help me drive forward. I just have to think of what can I do with what I got, where I'm at. And then, yes, there was someone that did a mistake that caused me to be paralyzed, but that person didn't do it on purpose, you know? It was a mistake. And I make mistakes all the time. It's just that I don't do anything as important as with people's lives. And for me, it was important not to be angry because, you know, we do our best, all of us. And the only thing you can learn is just to not do the same mistake again. And I thought it was important that the hospital really found out what happened and make sure that their routines were sharpened, because we could make sure it didn't happen again. That was where I put my energy. And you know, that was actually when I got a little bit angry, when they're like, oh, yeah, we don't really know if they implemented, you know, the learning points. I was like, oh, you are implementing the learning points. I will actually sit here outside your door until you can show me you implemented the learning points, because we don't want anyone else to go through this. And, you know, I can't change what happened with me, but you can sure make sure this doesn't happen again.
Yeah, it sounds like a major sign of respect to, at the very least, honor what happened to you by making sure that it doesn't happen again. You talked about your relationship with your mom, and it sounds pretty familiar, the wanting all this independence as a young adult, and her, you know, in a new situation as a mom also. I mean, her situation as a mom having changed so drastically when your situation changed too. How did she feel after your Paralympic success? Did she take off some of that pressure on herself to save you?
I think she was really happy, not only because of, you know, life turning out that way, but because she knew how much it meant for me, and how hard I worked for so many years, and how you have to make it a priority, and how much of your life it takes to do sports at that level. And the thing with sports is, it's not like studying, you know, if you put a certain amount of hour into studying, you will most probably get a degree. You put a certain amount of hours into sports, and it is definitely not sure whether you're going to get a medal. It's, you know, it's quite hard that way, you know, and anything can happen. I think that it was a mix, because she knew it meant a lot. She knew I worked really hard for it. She knew that I really tried my best. And then it was definitely also an element of,
it's turning out all right.
You know, she was really sad that my life wasn't going to be good, you know, that I wasn't going to be happy, that this was going to, that the injury was going to make my life not miserable, but not as fulfilling maybe. And I think that it was a very big example of life definitely being able to be fulfilling, even though it wasn't looking like the life that she had looked for me, you know, that she'd seen for me.
Mm-hmm. Ed, I think we have another picture.
So our next picture is from Norway's Dancing with the Stars. And this is you as a wheelchair user, the first contestant, celebrity contestant to be using a wheelchair on Dancing with the Stars. And this is, you're doing a handstand, your hands are on your chair, your legs are being supported, you're completely upside down, and you're in one of those Dancing with the Stars sort of tassel-y gowns. I'm not very good at describing.
That's the technical term, Ed. It's tassel-y gown. Yes.
Sparkles and all of that kind of thing. What's happening in this particular dance? And take us all the way back to, was it a phone call? How did you end up being on Dancing with the Stars in the first place?
Oh, this is a cha-cha, I see. We try to do something unexpected every dance, something that people would go like, what? Because, you know, so often, you know, especially in the time after I was paralyzed, people would say like, oh, but this isn't for you, or you can't do that. And it would really annoy me, and it still does really annoy me when people tell me what I can and cannot do based on their perspective and their experience, because their perspectives and experience might be a little bit limited, you know, especially defining my opportunities or my, what I can do, you know. And I think that what people think that other people can do might limit, you know, others. And by breaking boundaries and trying to show people there might be more to it than you know, and things that you might not think is possible, maybe we can do it still, you know. And when I was announced as one of the contestants in Let's Dance in Norway, it was a huge debate, you know, even before the first dance, because there were so many people coming out saying like, but what? You can't dance in a wheelchair. Oh, you have to have legs to be dancing. Oh, you have to bend your knees to do a proper dance. I was like, what the heck? No. Well, I'll show you. And my response kind of like, okay, they don't think we can do this. Let's show them. And I think that's maybe the most important thing we did with that show, that people saw there might be so much more that's possible than you think. And the dance floor is for absolutely everyone. It's not like only people in the wheelchair, you know, but some people say, oh, I don't have a dancing body. Hey, a dancing body is a body that can dance. That's not complicated at all. Your body is a dancing body. Join the dance floor. It's not that big of a deal. You just got to go try it, you know. Let's just not limit ourselves and not limit each other. Do our best and have fun. That's what life's about. And I think that we were able to do that on that show. You know, I did a handstand, I crawled on the floor, I jumped backflips, and I was hanging in the roof, and I did fly, you know, on top of Philip, which was my partner. And he would throw me around and I'd jump down, you know, as like we tried to really make the unexpected happen so that people would never try to tell anyone else what they can and cannot do.
Well, speaking of not knowing what you can and can't do, how did you guys go about choreographing all of that stuff?
Because there was no right answer, right? All the others, at least, you know, you have a professional dancer and then you have a celebrity. And the professional dancer, you know, would make the choreography and then they would teach it to the celebrity. But we couldn't work that way because he had no clue. Like he knew cha-cha or he knew samba or, you know, waltz, but he had no clue how I would move. So we had to do it together. And I think that one of the things that we got a lot of really good points on and remarks from the judges was that we were really good at working together and we were really good at kind of extend each other's bodies. So we were one almost from the very first day because we really had to go the way together. We really had to figure it out together. And we had to fall. We had to, you know, crash and burn. And we had to get up again.
You have to find your limits each time and then so you can get right close to them.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's a new dance every week, you know. So we just spent so much time on this. But it was such a fun thing. And I just loved it, you know, when all the kids, when I got videos from little kids, you know, sitting on the kitchen chairs, dancing, and they were like, oh, we want to be like the princess in Let's Dance, you know, she's dancing in a chair, I want to dance in a chair.
And we got people saying that their kid had a wheelchair, you know, and we're in school, and suddenly people thought the wheelchair was really cool. And that makes people, I think, see the people. See, one thing they can see the wheelchair as something cool, and then they will see the people in it, and not only see the wheels, right? You don't want to see the person, and that's important. And you have to get to know people. You have to get to know that person to be able to see the person, I think, too. And well, at least it helps.
Yeah, maybe you'll have some dance move named after you.
That's so cool.
Birgit, I'm intrigued because you also did Norway's version of The Masked Singer. And I love that show here in the U.S. And I'm curious, between the Dancing with the Stars and The Masked Singer, which one was more difficult? I saw a video of you sing, and by the way, you have a lovely voice. But I'm just wondering, between those two, which one did you think was more difficult, or was it just two very different experiences?
It's very different. But I think that Dancing with the Stars is demanding in a different way, because you always push the limits of your body. While in The Masked Singer, it was more about stepping out of the comfort zone and really give it your best, you know, even though you don't feel that like you have it. Like, I think it's really important to try to challenge yourself. And you feel really naked when you sing. You feel very naked, and it's very like, you can't just mess around or just have fun with it. you have to do that too, but you also got to give it your best, and it's vulnerable. The dancing is vulnerable too, but you're kind of gutsing into it, while the singing is, especially when you're inside the mask, it's a different thing. But I think when the dancing was, it was physical, demanding in a different way. And also because I think a lot of people had a lot of opinions about it. So you have to be a part of the debates, which can be challenging. While when you're in The Masked Singer, no one knows it's you. So you also feel a bit protected in a way. And for me, that's living quite a public life in Norway. It was actually a relief just being me, and there was no fuzz about it, you know, until afterwards, though. But when I was doing it, it was kind of my thing. And that was a little bit fun.
It sounds like you have chosen a lot of things, a lot of projects and pursuits because, partly at least, because of how difficult they are. Do you find that you sometimes choose things because they are difficult, or because people say you can't do them, even if you don't like them? Or does it have to be something you're interested in also?
I'm intrigued by things that's difficult because it demands something. And it's cool to try to do something which is hard and really have to stretch to make it. It challenges you in a different way, I think. And if you keep on trying to do things that's difficult and try to go out of the comfort zone, I think it helps me to grow. And sometimes you make it and sometimes you don't. But usually my experience is that if you put enough energy into it and you put enough effort and you do it seriously, you know, you can get quite far with anything. And of course, work with good people around you. You know, it's very seldom that you can do something totally by yourself. Usually you have to be part of a team, have to lean on people. That's really good.
I know your degree is political science, and you've done all these incredible things. You've kind of educated by showing with your gold medals and Summer and Winter Paralympic Games and Masked Singer and Dancing with the Stars and everything else. But is there a political ambition one day when sport is completely finished to pursue that at local level, or I don't know, national level there in Norway?
I did actually. I was elected into the city council in Oslo. I was in the committee of finance for 4 years. And that was really interesting. I think what's interesting with politics is that you can actually, you have the tools to make a difference. You know, you have the tools to actually change society. And I think that's one of the things that's really interesting with society, with democracy, that it's never finished in a way. It's always something that you can shape up a little bit, you know, or change or make different. And having the opportunity to do that, you know, and being able to contribute in actually fixing or changing the things that we can see that we're able to do something about, I think that's really interesting and cool.
We know that you currently serve on the IPC Athlete Council. What do you hope to achieve, or what kind of progress do you hope the Paralympic movement makes going forward?
I really hope that the Paralympic movement can be even more visible, because I think it's such a great force in showing the abilities in people and community, how much you can do, what you got, and how we can help each other, you know, being a part of the same ambition, you know, making everyone a part of an equal part of society. You know, my class in rowing, it used to be called Women, Arms and Shoulders. It's not called Women, No Legs. It doesn't matter, you know, you're not using the legs because you're not going to compete with them. You're going to compete with your arms and shoulders. And I think that's very transferable to many other parts of society too. You get a job because you're good at something, not because of what you're not good at. And we need to see each other as resources, you know, no matter where we're from or what we're doing. We need to be in eye height of each other and work as a team. Society is the greatest team of them all.
Very true. Thank you so much for being such a great guest, giving us so much time today. We really have loved talking to you.
It was really nice visiting too. Thank you for having me.
That was Birgit Skarstein. I'm glad I didn't say it wrong in front of her. She was great.
Yeah. So many strings to her bow, so many things that it's easy to say something she's good at, but so many things that she is good at because she has taken on those challenges, whether it's the sporting challenge and summer and winter games and dancing and brand new choreography and all that, singing, all this stuff. Some people are just good at everything. And actually, they're only good at everything because they have a mindset to understand and process and find a way to be good at it. And yeah, I thought that was incredible.
Well, and also I think to be open to different things, that seemed to be really important to her, to try out whatever comes her way, and no matter how difficult it is, and see where she can take it.
I really appreciated hearing about her outlook on life, her mindset. You can sense that there's a little bit of the stubborn, maybe even rebel aspect to her. And I think that's really served her well. You see that in many athletes, that is a quality that is necessary to be an elite athlete. And I think that attitude of, you know, I'm going to do it and I'm going to show you and I don't need any handouts along the way, has really helped her in her life. And you can just tell that determined will. I'd say that was the other thing I got from her. This is a person of very, very strong willpower. And but I love that. And I love that she was just so fiery and has just this huge personality that's so positive and very, very bubbly. I've found that very lovely.
But it seems like she's also wise about checking in with herself. I wonder if it's almost like the way that athletes would review their own tapes and look at their own performance, not just in sports, but also in her life. Like, is this working out for me? Is the way that I'm approaching this the way that I want to be approaching things, in a way that I think a lot of people are kind of scared to do?
Yeah. And I really liked anger was not the overriding emotion when what happened to her happened to her. It's an incredible sort of mindset that allows you to think like that, because I personally don't believe that I would be that person. I think I'd be bitter, I'd be enraged, I'd be all kinds of negative things. But to say that's not going to help, so I'm going to put that over there and I'm going to do this instead, I think shows real, whatever that is, strength of character, strength of personality, or just awareness. That was a real eye-opener, I think.
And just her ability to live in the present. As human beings, so many people are not able to get to that place, right? You have something that's very traumatic, possibly catastrophic, that happens to you. It's very, very difficult to be in the present, to look forward when you've had something so tragic happen.
Yeah. Well, and you'd have societal support for mm-hmm. not being in the present. Like, I feel like everybody would expect someone to dwell on the past or what could have been and support them doing that. So it's kind of a journey that she had to decide to go on her own and to forge on her own.
Well, that's it from me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. And join us next time for more of this.
you go from 120, which is fine, 125, 130, 35. Now I'm like on my aerobic threshold kind of thing. And 140, 145, 150, now I'm anaerobic. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to take my heart rate there today. And it's like, will I have a stroke and die?
How Olympic gold medal winning speed skater Denny Morrison came back from a motorbike accident and a stroke a year later to make it back to the games. Next time on The Podium.
When you meet someone online, can you trust they are who they say they are?
I just started to interact with this person.
I keep thinking so much about you.
Love, Janessa, a true crime podcast from the BBC World Service and CBC Podcasts, investigating the murky world of online romance scams.
It's all well planned.
She said, if you really loved me, you'd do what I asked you to do.
Catch up with the whole series now. Search for Love, Janessa, wherever you found this podcast.